Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live a good life and to create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social, conscious, and unconscious dynamics and desires. Welcome to this episode of Edgy Ideas. I'm delighted to have a very special guest, Trevor Hoff. Trevor's living in South Africa, in the bush, and I'm very pleased to be speaking with him. Trevor is an ANC-trained coach. He's a clinical psychologist. He's an analytic psychotherapist. And for the last few years, he's been working as an organizational consultant, often in fintech, in Asia, in India, in Europe. And Trevor brings a specific view of how to work in organizations, which he draws on from his life, living and working, and his passion in nature. Trevor, you're very welcome to Edgy Ideas. How are you?
Simon, thank you so much. It's lovely to spend time with you this morning. I'm really, really well, thank you. Kind of loving being out here right in the Kruger National Park.
Yeah, there's not many people I'm envious of, but you're one of them, Trevor. I'm itching to come across and visit you in Kruger.
As I've always said, the invitation is there, and I look really forward to seeing you in person. I think it's over a year since we last met.
It is. And every time we speak, you say, I had an amazing experience. I was out there and there was an elephant or there was a lion. And tell us a bit about where you live. Let's start off kind of where you live and what you're doing out there.
Yeah, Simon, I've been very fortunate. I left Europe. Normally my life is based, I work in Asia, I work in India, I work in Europe. And I think it was February. Last February, I was in Europe. I left, flew back. The coronavirus was just starting out, and I thought I'd be back in Europe in 2 months. When I realized that it was going to take a lot longer, I decided to relocate myself up to the Kruger National Park. I've spent a lot of time in the bush from when I was very, very young. I think inside, I'm a frustrated veterinarian. I think I first came to the Kruger National Park with my parents when I was 6 weeks old, and I've been coming here ever since. And it's a place where I feel very at home, and I feel really kind of at ease and comfortable. I had always wanted to do my training as a game ranger or as a game guide, and COVID provided the most wonderful opportunity. I was able to move up. I'm in outside a little town called Hoedspruit, in a park attached to the Kruger National Park. Most of the game parks around here, the fences have been dropped down. So it really creates this one massive ecosystem where animals move in and out of. I've been able to get some good Wi-Fi. I came up and did my training as a game ranger, which is I'd always wanted to do, and just continued staying here. I'm working, like most of us are, on Zoom. I try every single morning to go out walking, get up here at about 4:30 in the morning, go walk, and then come back and work. In the evenings, as it's starting to get dark, I'll either go for a walk out or I'll take the Land Rover out and go out for a drive or a walk in the evening. That's my day. It's been the most wonderful opportunity for me to really spend some time back in nature, a long period of time in a way I'd never thought I could before, and learned a lot more about myself and also about the work that I'm doing. I think it's really enriched the work a lot.
So that's what we want to talk about today, is the connections between nature and living closely to nature and the ecosystems in which you see in the environment around you. And making connections to leadership and to organizational culture. Now, you know, I write a lot about eco-leadership, and people often say, yeah, we get it, Simon. And they get it conceptually, but I want to talk to you, Trevor, because you get it kind of, you're embodied in this. So talk to me a bit about the links you make between kind of the natural world and organizational and leadership. Let's open a conversation.
That's great, Simon. I think it's such an important point, because I do think that theoretically people understand this idea of eco-leadership or eco-systemic leadership, but I don't know if exactly what you said, it sinks in or it is embodied. You know, I think that one of the most important parts for me that I learned from you is that we live within ecosystems, within ecosystems, within ecosystems. We cannot but live within those ecosystems. And yet, fundamentally, we are often unaware of what those systems are. I am, like you, have worked in organizational culture, and we've read all about it, and we understand its importance. However, I think that the thing that I most worry about when people talk about organizational culture is that people think of it like a orchid in a bell jar is the best way that I can describe. And I think you came up with that term. And that is that a culture is like something we can touch and change, and it happens within a vacuum. I think what I've really started to understand through this pandemic, and I think the virus is a response to interactions between numerous systems and us not paying attention. What is it? What do I get from the bush in it? And I think one of the most important parts that I've learned here is the ancient art of animal tracking, and that is kind of following animal spoor, understanding the environment and what happens, and seeing how all of this fits together within the bush. You know, I arrived up here, and I'll tell you the story. I managed to find a charter flight up, and because at that time we were really locked down in South Africa, and I spent the first month of here in a small tent in a camp in a reserve part of the Kruger Park called Pridelands, and this is where I was going to do my training. And I arrived later one afternoon. The Land Rover dropped me off, and it was around a watering hole, and they warned me at night that the elephant came through the camp. And that first night I was lying there, and I couldn't and heard this noise and heard the elephants coming in, and I thought they would keep their distance. But very quickly, I realized they were standing over my tent and brushing against it. And I poked my head outside the tent, and there was this massive big elephant around. And let's say the first night was not the easiest to sleep. And the next morning, everybody had a good laugh. And I very quickly thought, wow, we're going to learn how to walk with elephants. And something really amazing happened. There was a young tracker who trained me for the first 2 weeks of being here. And what we did for those first 2 weeks is that we walked around this dam or this watering hole, and it was a gravel track and a sand track. And we would walk around, and he would point out things, point out and listen to sounds, smells, and he would start asking questions. What spoor is that? What spoor is that? What smell is that? What sound is that? What they call it in the bush is they call it situational awareness, where you become aware of the environment that you're functioning in. You look and let's say, well, I can see there's elephant spoor, and it was walking in a northerly direction. And you can see that probably happened last night because of the freshness of it. And next to it, on top of it, I can see a leopard spoor. And I can see that the leopard spoor is there too. There's one small one, and that's a female leopard and its baby. And as I walk along, you can get a smell. And you smell, and elephants, I mean, leopards, when they mark their territories, because they're very territorial creatures, spray. They use the urine spray, and you can smell the popcorn. And so you're smelling this. And then there's a certain kind of bird you might hear, which is called an oxpecker. And we know that the oxpeckers take ticks off these animals. Mm-hmm. And so by hearing and observing and getting a feeling of all these things, you can draw a three-dimensional picture of what's happened the night before and what's happening right now. And you can start projecting into the future what will happen. Because if I carry on walking around that corner and I know that leopard's there with its cub, the chances of me getting taken out are quite high. So we have to read that in order to keep us safe. Now, it's the most wonderful thing, because once you get used to that, once you become aware situationally of what's happening around you, you can predict. And nature is very predictable when you really pay attention.
Yeah.
The way I draw to leadership is that my experience in working in organizations has been that people are cut off from their senses. We walk into, I remember walking out of Bank Station in London early in the morning, looking at my mobile phone, following the map, getting to a station. I'm not even aware of who was around me. I don't smell anything. I don't hear anything. I just get in. I walk into the office. I walk up to my area where I'm working. I don't really notice the other teams or what's going on, what else is happening in the building. And I truly believe that's what's led to this, I would call, silification of our organizations. Things that happen either within our organization or even between teams in organizations. We become disconnected.
Yeah, and I experience life at the moment, and had done for 2 or 3 years, really, a really increase in situational unawareness. It's almost like we're becoming more and more unaware. you know, people bump into you, people kind of absorbed by their mobile phones, by their own lives. And it seems to me like we're developing smaller and smaller worlds in our heads, and being that we don't even have a relational awareness around us, let alone awareness of wider ecosystems. And I think it's a real challenge for our times.
I could not agree with you more. You know, Simon, I mean, you and I both worked as therapists, and I suppose we continue to do some of that work. And I truly believe that the rise in mental health difficulties in the world is because we live in dehumanized spaces, and dehumanized in the sense that we're cut off from the very species that we are.
Yeah.
I mean, it's what's so interesting to me is that if we go back to Marx's early writing, he talked about that species alienation. For an economist, I think he was pretty spot on. And I do think we've become totally cut off from that. And I do believe that to humanize organizations means reconnecting with that, reconnecting ourselves with what it is to be human in a system, because organizations are just another ecosystem within wider ecosystems.
They are, you know, and that's exactly kind of what I try and say to people, that, you know, organizations are ecosystems within ecosystems, and it's fundamental to a way of thinking, but it's actually very hard to land. People get that conceptually, but again, it's going back to what you said about culture. I think it's very interesting. People talk about how can a CEO change culture? And in my leadership books, I say very rarely does a CEO change culture. They actually swim in cultures, and they're selected by that culture to represent that culture. They're shaped by that culture. They're, you know, we get the same kind of thinking repetitively because people come from the same MBA courses, the same Harvard Business Schools, the same. They're produced by the same consultants. They're producing the same thinking. So they're actually products of the culture rather than shaping it. And very rarely do you get individuals who can actually inspire and change cultures. It's not something in this bell jar. It's not this orchid in this bell jar. We water and we shape. You know, culture, we are part of culture as we are part of nature. And I totally agree with you around COVID. We've always treated, modernity treats nature like it's something out there which we can use as a resource, or we can go and look at because it's beautiful, or we can shape to our own imaginations. And actually, it forgets that we are nature. Nature is us. And that's the kind of massive missing link which you're pointing to, I think.
Simon, I absolutely couldn't agree with you more. I was sitting the other evening at a dinner outside, because we socially distance here. Unfortunately, we've got lots of outside places to eat. And I was sitting with a chap who's an ecologist at one of the game reserves. And he was complaining that he had got into ecology because he was interested in working with animals. And now he was working mostly with human and communities around these game reserves. And I was quite taken back. And the conversation I had with him was, well, what part of the world did you not think that humans were an animal, were a species on this planet?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It was quite a revelation for him to kind of think of it in that way. You know, ecology is about looking at the interaction of all species with their environments, both biotic and abiotic. And we're just another species. We might, you know, kind of have in our delusions, but more control and power right now. But we're not. We're just like any other species, and disease impacts us in the same way that it does any other species in this planet. And perhaps that's the thing that we're starting to, and you and I talk about a lot, which is this fallacy of control, fallacy yeah. that somehow we can control the systems we function within.
Yeah, it's a huge, I mean, I relate it back to the Industrial Revolution, to controller leadership, to machine mindsets. And, you know, people elevated science to the new faith. People elevated science and rationality, believing that if you apply science and rationality to nature and to human nature, you could civilize people. And yet we you know, you could tame nature, you could tame the wilderness and use it for our own benefits, and you could tame human nature. So you could get people to become more civilized and more science and rationality applied. And yet that was a massive mistake. And as we saw, the kind of the opposite happened. Now you applied rationality and science to war. You applied rationality and science to the Holocaust. You applied rationality and science to how you create nuclear weapons. So that, you know, rationality and science is useful as part of what we do as human beings, but it's only one part. And it's these connections and these interdependencies which are really, really missing.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I think that's the part that we miss out on, is that we humans are relational beings, like any of the other creatures on this planet. And I think we miss out on that relationship. We think that somehow the scientific knowledge, the capacity to measure, and I see it with developments of algorithms, this kind of idea of big data. It's almost that people think that it's going to change the world. I think it's useful. It's useful in the sense of how we interact with it as human beings, how we relate to it. But it's that. But I often think that even data scientists miss out the fact that it is a relational process with that data that is useful, not just to us, but to the wider planet.
I think people split things off, you know, as our Klein in psychoanalysis teaches us, you know, we split good and bad off, you know, so you know, we're good, they're bad, you know, and this splitting takes place. What interests me is that even progressive thinkers who engage in my work and eco-leadership, and I work with, you know, there's a very quick slippage in organizations where you slip back to controller leadership, back to messiah leadership, back to therapist leadership, because we get that. We understand how to do therapist leadership, how to motivate people, how to work as a coach. We get controller leadership, you know, controlling resources, trying to be more efficient. We get messiah leadership, the language of kind of heroes. It's in Hollywood. It's all around us, you know. But to actually get eco-leadership remains a problem. Conceptually, people get it, but stepping into it remains a real challenge for kind of our mindsets, I think.
Let me give you an example, because I think what you say, it resonates so strongly with me. As I said, I go for walks every morning. Two mornings ago, we've been having big rains now, just before the rains came. I was walking down close to where I am right now. And when I walk around here, a lot of people carry rifles. I prefer not to carry a rifle. And I'll tell you a little bit about that just now with relation to hero leadership. But I was walking and kind of, I came across tracks of or spur of elephant. And I know there's a very close to here, there's a very big herd of breeding herd of elephant. Now, breeding herds are dangerous in the sense there are a lot of babies and elephants are matriarchal. And they have a very complex matriarchal society. And you stay away from, you keep your distance from them because they will charge you. But normally the male bulls, they live on their own. They stay outside of the herd. And they're normally quite placid and they're quite okay. But I came across, I saw this breeding herd, I stayed back. They were probably a couple of hundred meters away from me. They crossed into the riverbed. I let them go. I thought everything was fine. And I then carried on up, and suddenly out of nowhere, this big male bull came out. Now, he'd been chased out of this herd. And he became very upset with me. And he started flapping his ears and charging me. And it was quite a little, for a moment, it was frightening. I was able to move back into higher ground and eventually he moved off. But the reason I'm saying this to you, Simon, is that we have a big problem here right now with elephants because, and it's almost because of humans taking on anthropomorphizing animals. We fell in love with elephants. We see them as wise. We have this, and they're wonderful, beautiful creatures. Because there was a lot of poaching happening, there was kind of the ivory trade. We wanted to save, and a lot of money was placed, and quite rightly, into conservation of elephants. But what started happening is that around these game parks, like where I am, these lodges started growing up, and people paid lots and lots of money. People are paying £3,000-£4,000 per night to stay in some of these lodges, and these lodges put in water holes and pumped water in. And elephants are normally migratory creatures, and when things get dry in the winter months, yeah, they migrate somewhere else and they look for water. And when they migrate and there's a lack of water, they stop breeding.
Right.
Because all of these lodges kind of grew up and ecotourism took off, there's lots and lots of water. Now these elephants don't move. They stay in one place, they breed and they breed and they breed. And they are breaking down a lot of the trees and breaking down the rest of the ecosystem. You know, different animals are dying out and not living here anymore because there's nothing for them to eat. And we've got this proliferation of elephant. And because of that, the elephant's family structures have changed. And because the family structures have changed, some of these bulls are being kicked out and it leads to this aggression. Now, it was such an interesting thing to just observe this male, to understand perhaps a little bit of what he's going through and understanding that actually, what's contributed to this is such a wide interaction of kind of the thing that we tried to do good by building these lodges and bringing in tourists and making more water available actually destroys the ecosystem. It impacts in ways that we didn't even think about. The problem is right now is that even if you talked, because we have such limited areas, in the past, what they would do is they would cull, which means that you either hunt or get rid of certain, members of a herd because the area is just not big enough to carry them. Because there's been such a big kind of push in terms of looking after elephant and protecting and putting money that we can't even mention that anymore because it's just taboo subject. And so we just end up with more and more and more elephant around. And the impact of that in the environment is going to be huge. And I think that's the part that if we transport that into an organization, how do we do that in our organizations? I always say no good deed goes unpunished in a sense. And I think that's part of what we do. We put so many resources into one place without understanding the impact and the ripple effect it has on the wider system around it.
Yeah, it's absolutely right. So, if you take that idea of situational awareness, you go to the HR function, you go to the OD function, you go to the senior board, you go to kind of the engineers, and this kind of disconnection even within the organizational ecosystem itself is hugely problematic. I mean, you've worked in finance, and it's exactly why the finance industry kind of collapsed. Now, all the auditors were saying, giving people kind of high ratings and great stars like days before the whole system collapsed, because there was not that kind of wider systemic view about what was really going on. It was hidden. It was kind of split off. As long as people were making a profit, things continued. And that disconnect just continues and continues. And it's a real challenge for the thinking.
Absolutely. And so it's just such a beautiful part, because if I imagine what that elephant was doing, he was trying to show off to me and tell me who's boss. And I believed he was boss. But if I had to convert it into organizational talk, I would say that he was trying to bully me, which is quite right. He should. Yeah. But I'm busy doing a piece of work for an organization where bullying has been a big problem for a while. And their solution was to offer anti-bullying training, which was interesting. And obviously, you and I understand how little that works. But we've been brought in now to really help them try to understand and think about what does bullying really mean within a system. And what's been so beautiful is exactly this. We looked at how do the different parts of the system interact with each other? What are the interdependencies of it? And what we found is that there are very little. These are, even the units within this business are completely cut off from each other. The business is cut off from other parts of the business out there in the world. And aggression had to go somewhere. And it's being displayed through this idea of bullying. And so to get the organization to think about it differently, to think about it systemically, suddenly the possibilities of perhaps, not getting rid of bullying per se, but it will disappear when you understand its significance and purpose and usefulness within the system.
Exactly. What does it do on behalf of the system? What does that bully enact on behalf of the system?
Exactly. Exactly.
What I find interesting in some of this work is that there's quite a lot of people working in biomimicry and there's a fad going on around biomimicry. So let's learn from nature and put that into organizations. And I have some empathy with that. But in my work on the eco-leadership, one of the things I keep repeating to people is that the ecosystems we work in are social ecosystems, technological ecosystems, and environmental ecosystems. And whilst humans are species, we're a specific species. We have a specific way, as elephants have a specific way, as any other species of insects or viruses, they have their specific ways. And we have to understand kind of the human specific systems we're working in and link those to the technological ecosystems and then environmental natural ecosystems as well. And making those connections is kind of what connects us all together.
I absolutely agree with you. I think that the idea that biomimicry exists on its own, or that we need to bring nature into our businesses, is again a neglect of the fact that we are part of that. It's not that you bring it in, it's that you understand it and understand yourself as part of it.
How that links to the other actors in the network. I mean, I studied actor network theory at Lancaster University, and that was a big, big shift for me. When I worked at the Tavistock, and we used to do organizational observation, and it's great. You go and you observe an organization, and I had my students observing organizations, and they come back and they report to me kind of what was going on. And like 99% of what they'd observe was people. As if organizations are just people. And I'm like, where was the technology? Where was the environment? You know, did you not notice the buildings, the nature around the building? Did you not notice it? And we're so absorbed. It's almost like a human kind of narcissism. We just absorb by ourselves. And when I got them to start looking at the actors in this network, you know, what makes a difference in this network? You know, the water cooler, you know, it draws people towards it. It's like your elephants, you know, the water hole kind of made by these kind of hotels. They draw the elephants, you know. Water holes draw people as well. You know, if you put, you know, you have to think about organizational design, just think about kind of all the impacts inside and outside organizations. And it's really a revelation. So if you train people to look at the actors in the network and think kind of what really makes a difference, you'll find that technology, humans, non-humans, animals, the environment, all these things are actors in these ecosystems.
I mean, Simon, I could not agree with you more in the sense of, if we think about ecology is not looking at animals. It's great. You come, you know, tourists come and they want to see elephant, they want to see lion, they want to see whatever else. And then you show them rocks. You show them, you know, intrusive, igneous rocks. Why are they here? Where do they come from? And actually, it's those very rocks and the breakdown of those rocks that allow an elephant to be there. It's the creation of sand. It's the weather that it increases. All of these are linked together, to create a wider system. It is not just the living creatures in the sense of animals, but the abiotic things as well in the system that are important to take note of.
Yeah, and of course this is ancient wisdom which we've lost. You know, I was in Australia last year and just again reminded of the Aboriginal culture and just how aware they are of the rocks and the water holes and the shapes and the whole environment. Is their ecology is encompassing all of this, and we've really got to kind of relearn that in our modern terms. You know, our environments these days are big cities, there are urban areas. You know, not everybody will be going to live in the bush, but you know, in a city, you know, cities. I mean, when I was in London, I used to use nature hugely. You know, the amount of nature in London, if you look for it, is kind of thriving. You know, every day I'd be down by the river. You know, you can kind of find it, and we have to kind of renew these cities and green these cities and change them as we do our organizations.
Completely. I mean, I worry a little bit. I mean, I love living here and I think it's wonderful. And the idea of bringing people out into nature to do some leadership work and reconnect is part of what I love. However, I'm very wary of it simultaneously because I don't want to idolize it or create the split or the good bad that you should come out to nature to experience it. So I completely agree, which is what is the natural environment that you live in London? Look around you, become aware of it, live in it because it's there. It's part of you. You don't have to come to Africa to see that. Even though it might be nice to do it.
That's right, you know, and you know, me and you have talked, we hopefully will do something in Africa at some stage together, but it's not to make it kind of an elite trip where kind of people kind of fly out and they stay in a nice lodge and they take some photographs of the elephants and they do a bit of tracking and then they go back and say that their lives have been transformed. You know, those sorts of trips don't work. It's about immersing yourself in a very, very different way. And you can do that wherever you are. You can do that wherever you are. I mean, I used to take people in London to the Tate Modern, and it's very interesting. I used to invite them to wander the Tate Modern on an exercise I called Locating Ourselves. And it is fascinating because we do a talk on actor network theory before, and we get people to think about non-animate objects in their lives. And people would respond to the artwork, they respond to the architecture. Some people would walk out to the River Thames and respond to the pebbles on the beach. People would be drawn to different parts of it. And then you get those people back and you get them in a group and share what they've got. And you start building an ecology in the mind. It was really interesting. You know, you start building an ecology because people are drawn to different things and they share things. And people start building these connections, these interdependencies. And then they go back into their workplace and they start looking at their workplace different. And that's what we really try to do is, how do you make a link with nature, with these ecologies we were part of, to change organizations in a more humane, a more kind of environmentally resourceful way?
You know, it's so interesting. I think you'll like this story. Your use of the word locate, I think, is so important. And it just sparked something with me. Last week, I was doing a piece of work with a financial services company that have a whole lot of new graduates that have come in London. And they're obviously all working from home. And I was doing an induction and in an orientation process with these graduates. And they're all, you know, bushy-tailed, starry-eyed, but quite anxious at the same time. And I'd been brought in to have a conversation with them about networking. And it was so interesting to kind of throw out the idea of kind of doing an exercise, first of all, of networking in the mind. Like, what do you imagine networking to be? And all of them were kind of like had this idea that it was about sucking up, about, you know, kind of handing over your card or having a, you know, walking up to somebody at a cocktail party, which you can't do now. But, and I asked what the experience of thinking about it in that way was. And all of them said it created massive anxiety because who do you connect to? Who do you, how do you do this? How do you do the doing? And it was so interesting because I said, well, what happens if we stop trying to do and stop thinking about networking and start becoming observant and locating yourself in the network you find yourself in?
Yeah.
And let's draw a network map. Yeah. Let's map the network. And it was such an interesting thing for them to locate themselves in the network, in the wider, not just in their business, but kind of professional, friendship, peer groups, support groups. And suddenly what was so wonderful to watch is as they located themselves in a network and saw the networks that they were in, rather than having to create a network, the anxiety dissipated and they felt more comfortable. And at the end, somebody came up and said, well, oh my gosh, I have to be an anthropologist in the system rather than a creator of networking.
Absolutely. And as you know, in this analytic network coaching, we have five frames, and one of the frames is network analysis. And that's precisely what we do. I've designed a network analysis mapping system. And what I find is that you have to get somebody to locate themselves in their own network as a starting place. And then when they do that, when they start realizing and building the network out and they work with a coach, you can start asking them what's lacking in that network, what's missing. And it's really interesting. Then they say, oh yeah, I forgot my family, or I forgot what kind of the nature, and you're, where's the technology in the network? Where's the other parts of this ecosystem? And then you move themselves from the center of the network to the edge and say, what does it look like to be on the edge of that network? What does it feel like to be disconnected within this group? And you can start playing with it, but starting people kind of at the center and saying, build your own network around you, is to me vital, because it actually engages people and they start to embody their networks rather than kind of thinking like culture, it's something out there that they can change or they can join. They're actually a part of an interdependent connectedness in a network. And that's an important kind of a piece of work.
Yeah. I mean, and Simon, I remember doing that piece with you and it was such a powerful experience. And I think that there's something, you know, one of the things I'm really grateful of having done psychotherapy training and analytical psychotherapy training was that learning to observe what's in the room, but also what's not in the room.
Yeah.
And I think that for me, that one of the greatest things that we bring into organizational consulting is, which is not just observing what's there and being very aware, but also not what's not there, what's not just what's said, but also what's not said. And perhaps getting leadership to understand that and to kind of reflect on it, kind of, you know, not just what I see around me in my eyes, but also understanding that, you know, the nuances of that.
Sure, sure.
I have a question for you that I'd love to throw in, and that is about, we're talking about this and about ecosystemic leadership and these kind of how we, or system, eco-leadership and how we take this forward. This idea of, and it's really important for me right now, and thinking about what's happening in the US and in Russia and all over, this kind of strongman idea, this kind of hero leadership. And I'm intrigued because from working here in the bush, I've got some ideas, but I'd love to kind of get your sense of how you see it playing out and the risks and the damages that it's creating right now.
Yeah, well, in my typology of leadership, we have controller leadership, therapist leadership, messiah leadership, and eco leadership. And that's studying leadership over the past century, as you know. So the controller leadership was the Industrial Revolution, the mechanization, Fordist, Taylorism, really about controlling resources, including human resources. Therapist leadership was the human relations movement. That was very much about how we motivate people, how we use emotional intelligence, how we use soft people skills. And then there was a wave of messiah leadership, and that came in the 1980s. And that's very much about kind of hero leadership plus strong organizational cultures. And this is hugely kind of problematic because it's everywhere. It's part of our fairy tales. It's part of Hollywood. It's part of television. It's part of Netflix. Messiah leadership and hero leadership is endemic. It's everywhere. It's kind of hardwired into us, and it's repeated as a narrative, you know. And everybody who feels vulnerable has some sort of need for a savior. I mean, psychoanalytically, we think about when you're feeling anxious and vulnerable, there's a need for a good mummy or a good daddy to come and rescue us. There's an infantile kind of a response. And what we're seeing is where there's high anxiety, people are turning to infantile responses. They're turning to their good mummy or good daddy. And whether you project good daddy onto Trump, or whether you project it onto Biden or Putin, or good mummy onto Angela Merkel, you know, there's this hope that that some great leader will save us. And the same happens in the business world. You know, once Messiah leadership came about, once transformational leadership came about, the salaries of CEOs just rocketed. They went from like 40 to one of the average worker's wage to like 400, 500 to one, and they're still there. And people kind of hire these leaders as if they're going to be saviors of the industry or saviors of the country. And what it does is create a dependency culture. It creates kind of people who are dependent on a leader. We give away our power. We give away our thinking. We give away our emotional responses to the leader who will save us. And that is kind of hardwired into it. And it's something we have to continually kind of work with and challenge. And just to add, I also don't believe in some people who say, get rid of leaders altogether and be leaderless. You know, I do think we need some Messiah leadership. We do need some leaders who have vision of eco-leadership, who have vision of a new society. But we shouldn't be dependent on them, and we shouldn't hold them kind of in such high esteem that we can't become the leaders we all are. Each of us has leadership potential. Each of us has followership potential. Each of us has to kind of develop that potential. And you know, there are people with amazing charisma, some expertise. You know, Einstein was a brilliant person, can't be denied. You know, he showed leadership in the field of science. And you know, we need people like that. We need people like that to kind of work with, but not in that kind of Hollywood way where a machismo leader comes along to kind of create a bad enemy and a good us and creates all the kind of trouble which we see politically in the world around us at the moment. I don't know if that helps.
No, completely. And I mean, it resonates completely with me, because this idea, and I really truly hold and believe this strongly, that leading is a verb. It's something we do. That there might be people who do it more often than others, but it's something we do. And it, you know, at times in this conversation, you take the lead, I follow you, and it shifts and it moves, and it's an interesting one. And I really, that you said the word vulnerability, and I truly believe that to humanize organizations, to kind of make us more systemically aware, it requires reframing vulnerability to being from something weak to something important and something essential in order to fit into the environment. And I use that example that I said to you earlier on. One of the things I noticed here is that, you know, the armor that people wear up here in the bush. And there are lots of gung-ho, machismo kind of people. And that is this big, you know, these big rifles. Yeah. And as if, you know, you see them. You see the guys walking through there with their big rifles and
strutting.
And I must say, I walk a lot without my rifle. And for an important reason. If I have to walk with clients and I had to take a group of people out, if I took you out, by law, I would have to walk with a rifle, because that's how the law is. But actually, maybe I wouldn't take you out with a rifle. I think you and I would go walk on our own. But there's something about putting the armor down for me that allows me to become part of the system in a way that my vulnerability makes me more aware of what's happening around me. It also makes me be able to watch how different parts of the system take up power and give it up at different points. I mean, everybody has this great idea that lions are the king of the jungle. If you spend time with lion, you realize that they are probably one of the most vulnerable of creatures out here. They get chased off, they're killed by hyena all the time. In fact, their baby, you know, less than 50% of lion cubs make it to adulthood. They die of diseases. Male lions in the wild only live to about 10 years of age, whereas if they're in captivity, they could live to close to 20. And the reason they only live to 10 years old is because they as other lions, kind of males, get into breeding age and get strong, they come and challenge these lions. And most lions, male lions, die at around the age of 10 because they get killed by other lions. And so power shifts between them constantly. Elephants hold power at a certain time, and other times they get chased off and killed by big prides of lion, which people don't even often understand that. But it, for me, the important part is to watch these power shifts and who takes the lead and who follows and how people react to this, rather than this defense of armor that we carry. And I think that is really, really useful from a leadership point of view.
I think you're right. And, you know, one thing I write about in my books and repeat often is that, you know, leadership and followership are fluid. That even if you're a chief executive, if you're the president of the United States, you know, you still have to learn when to follow. And that's so important that, you know, followers become leaders, leaders become followers. They're two sides of the same coin. And we all kind of have the capacity for both. In many different ways, you know, it's why I don't believe in any kind of set leadership competences, because everyone has a unique way of leading and following, and it's about discovering our own ways. And what you're saying about vulnerability, it reminds me of something I think about with anxiety as well. I often say, let anxiety be your teacher, and it's like, let your vulnerability be your teacher. When you're feeling vulnerable, when you're feeling anxious, you know, Our immediate response is to react. You know, we want a savior hero, or we want to be defensive, or we get, you know, we get angry. But if you listen to kind of what that anxiety means for you, if you listen to what that vulnerability means to you, you get that situational awareness again, which you've talked about, then it becomes a teacher and you can learn from it. And if you can do that, that is great leadership.
You know, Simon, I couldn't agree more. The point of that point of, like, if I mean, we hear it in psychotherapy all the time, you know, the psychiatric movement moved away from therapy into medicating, take away the anxiety rather than listening to it.
Yeah.
And what concerns me the most is that if you don't just sit with anxiety and let it pass, you can't think.
That's right.
And if you can't think in a leadership perspective, how can you be situationally aware? It requires thinking, not reacting.
That's right. Trevor, it's been a fantastic conversation, and you reminded me of my trip to the Kruger many years ago when I saw a lioness come out of the trees, and one of the most moving things I've ever seen, very close to me across a riverbank. So I look forward to visiting you sometime in the future. You and I should definitely kind of sit down and write a short online course together, working with these ideas. I'd love to really kind of do something which people can engage with where they are in their own situations. So let's talk about that after this show. Trevor, I'd like to finish and ask a question I ask all my guests about how to live the good life and what it takes to create a good society, drawing on your experiences. What's your thinking on that, Trevor?
Sure, Simon. I think it's such a good question. In a sense, for me, there is something about authenticity, about going within and finding what makes me comfortable, but also in a sense of how do I connect and fit into this world around me, rather than thinking that I'm perhaps above it or outside of it. And I think that when I feel part of it and I see it as myself as part of it, I think it makes me more empathic and it allows me to connect with the wider system in a much better way.
Great advice. More empathic and more alive, Trevor. Been lovely talking to you. You go well. Take care.
Take care of yourself as well, Simon. Lovely chatting to you.
Thank you for listening to Edgy Ideas. If you enjoyed our podcast and would like more information about our coaching, training, and events, please contact simon@analyticnetwork.com or go to www.analyticnetwork.com. Thank you for listening.